Reading number 11, Boredom Transition. Stepping from the train in Delhi, 9 months furlough in Europe, blurred as in a dream. My uniform, a straitjacket, no longer fit. I closed my eyes, blotting out the present. My battalion and Lansdowne's dreary depot lay 17 gut-wrenching miles ahead. Hair bends twisted through thick forest, skirting terraced fields and villages. Dizzied, sick, I needed frequent breaks. "This very good, clean place?" My driver braked beside a roadside hotel, an unlikely-looking shack built against a hillside. Pungent spices, rice and dal bubbled in charcoal-blackened pots. A banana leaf for a plate, fingers and fire-roasted chapati for spoon, served with a tin cup of sugared buffalo milk tea. The simple meal rekindled my love affair with India. A land of sweet surprises, a land where no traveller passed by unfed. To serve a stranger was to serve God. "Namaste," the owner welcomed, bowed, hands clasped. "Namaste," he welcomed my driver. I offered cigarettes all around. Companionable, replete, I was back. Arriving at the hill station, the commanding officer informed, our battalion's 2-year stint on the northwest frontier was over. Purposeless soldiering yawned. Monday, collective training. Tuesday, company training. Wednesday, battalion training. Friday, brigade training. I was a pawn. We all were. Duties so negligible I concluded the explanation for our being there was just that, our presence. Even in the 20s, there were whisperings the days of the British Raj were coming to an end. In 1928, I contracted malaria. During my convalescence in the Nilgiri Hills, the Simon Commission arrived at the Dog's Home, the 2-storied European-style house gifted to Britain by the steel magnate Lord Tata. Their mission? Haggle the contentious issue of partition. A Captain Attlee, a member of the Commission, stretched languidly in an adjacent rattan lounger on the veranda one day after lunch and started chatting. Bold, direct, I asked about the possibility of partition. "Over my dead body!" he shouted. "Over my dead body!" His vehemence stayed with me. Malaria worsened. I was repatriated to England's cooler clime for 1 year's sick leave. With the officer's convalescent hospital on the Isle of Wight, Osborne House, a favourite summer palace of Queen Victoria as my home, another idyllic year passed unfettered, ununiformed, golf, squash, croquet, picnics on the lawn, tennis, and nightly sneakings down the fire escape to Saturday night dances at the Sandown Hotel. I played the field and loved. Though run on military lines, Osborne House was more a country club than a nursing home. I made a particular friend of a fellow patient, Colonel Ogilvy, newly retired. Unashamed and naked, I found him in the sun pavilion darning his stocks, for no other reason than that he liked the feel of the sun on his body. Unlike me, he spoke his mind and did only what pleased him, even if it dented his career. "If it was good enough for Caesar, sir, it is good enough for me," he'd once retorted to a brigadier critical of his manoeuvres during an exercise. I laughed, envious of his forthrightness. "Conformity kills, compromise castrates, your beliefs are what counts," he'd snort. His dictum stuck, and I adopted them as my own. Pronounced fit, I sailed again for India. I'd hardly unpacked before my regular 2-month leave fell due, and I was off again. "Really?" I checked in disbelief. The Hoti called. I'd used those months to explore it, and did. A pass, I discovered, bears my name. A dot on the Indian Army survey map reads, Number 53N, sketched by Captain Rose. I love thee, Himalaya, your rainbow meadows, grass fingers, your folds in which to lie above the valley of the flowers and the kulu. Chapter 42. Choices Transition. Elated from my adventures in the Hoti, the thought of another round of quick march and a 1-2-3 about the parade ground groaned unbearable. I had enough. My mind was clear. Peacetime soldiering was not for me. Spoiled, seduced, too much leisure, too long absent, I was stuck. "Bit of an oddball, that Rose," I once overheard my peers remark. I wasn't offended, quite pleased, really. I took it as a compliment. Perhaps I was different. My impoverished upbringing, tainted legacy of my parents' affair, paranormal experiences, long absence, my disrespect for rules, the army's constraints. With my roommate, Harry, we considered and dismissed choices. Somaliland, Camel Corps, British trade agent in Tibet, Burma military police, Assam rifles, become an aide-de-camp to His Excellency the Viceroy of India. "To be an aide-de-camp, you need private means, Hugh." Harry scotched that choice. I could veer completely off the career rails by seconding to one of the so-called irregular frontier militia. Romantic for a year, oh yes, but a career based in some more isolated fort than Landi Kotal, its covert raids, constant sniper fire, at tracking tribal insurgents in waterless mountains? No, sir. Though I wouldn't have foregone time spent on the northwest frontier, my lonely sojourn in the picket, the tented and barg forts, nor bounding races down the Kud with my Gurkha men, not for anything. Abbottabad, Banu, Razmak, Wana, and Keta, as with the French Foreign Legion, mystique hovered around their names, Job Militia, Chitral Scouts, South Waziristan Scouts, Kurum Militia. The irregular forces who taught their skills to Britain's frontier brigades. Two-thirds of the entire British army was stationed on the Afghan-Indian border, present-day Pakistan, to give soft peacetime troops an experience of live gunfire. I settled for the Foreign and Political Department, otherwise known as Fazul and Pomp Department. Fazul equaled foolishness in Persian. Fazul? Was I a fool? Time would tell. Pomp? The Derber filling Bareilly's streets, caparisoned elephants, massed marching bands, swinging kilts, bagpipes, and the Maharajas and Maharanis, emeralds and sapphires, theatrical drama governed. But that was not my reason. I chose the Foreign Service to better understand our role in India, experience India without a gun, to work alongside differing ethnic and religious groups, Hindus, Muslims, tribals, Eurasian and British civilians. Foreign Service handled Indian penal code, revenue and civil law, opium regulations and the workings of internal security. So much to learn. Two interviews lay between me and my appointment. I travelled to the newly established capital, New Delhi. The Foreign Secretary saw me first, next the Viceroy himself, Lord Irwin. I was as charming as I knew how, for social skills were as important as intellect for the post. "Hugh could charm the monkeys from the trees," friends teased encouragingly. My interview involved an elaborate luncheon at Viceroy House. My dress, table manners, and every smile fell under scrutiny. 200 guests and I stood waiting, arraigned behind gilt chairs before the most long, most heavily laden table I'd ever seen, preceded by two ADCs, the Viceroy and Vicerain, swept into a hushed banqueting hall. They took their places. The first bar struck. God save the King. Ladies curtsies, men bowed, scarlet, royal blue, uniforms, silk gowns and saris rustled as maharajas, governors and high officials took their seats to the flash of precious stones and military medals caught in the light. At the far end I took mine. The viceroy's bodyguards, immobile at attention along both walls, stood, chests thrust out, a lance in each man's hand, and scarlet pugris on their heads, one pleated end of which, fanned proud in a coxcomb, one end dangled pigtail-like. Impassive, eyes unblinking, they stood still as the frozen figures in the oil paintings hanging behind them. After such a banquet, during his official tour of India, Edward, Prince of Wales, was overheard laughing to his equerry, "Now I know how royalty really should live." Truly, the viceroy lived like a king. Back. I soon heard I was through. My appointment, Assistant Deputy Commissioner, Bareilly. My last days with the regiment telescoped alarmingly to one. Suddenly it was time. Time to abandon my regiment, brother officers, and my Gurkha men. No longer one of them. Standing on the mess lawn with my friends after being formally dined out, I half regretted the step I'd taken. The full moon rose, silvering distant Himalayan snows. The regimental band closed the evening with the haunting hymn, "Abide with me, fast grows the evening tide." My chest and throat constricted, each star smudged blurry one by one as the bugler's last post evaporated skywards. Ramrod straight as the national anthem played, I could only mouth the words, "God save the king." Shadows on the moonlit lawn blackened our faces, hid my emotion. Harry Garland clapped his hand hard across my back, walked with me in silence to our bungalow for the last time.